Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the last day of the month of September. Can you believe it? The last day of the month of September. We have October, November, December, and then we're with this year. It's gone. Yeah. It's out. So our last quarter, as it were, I say to the head of the business council. I know you worry about quarters and such.
Of course.
Well, we are, so it's our last day of September, and we will, and it's also Friday, and we're excited about that. We have a great panel. Let me introduce them to you, and we'll get started and talk about what is going on. We were just playing the music of Ally McGurk playing at the Linda tomorrow night, October 1st at 8 p.m. That's WAMC's Performing Arts Studio. And if you go to thelinda.org, you can find out more information. Ally McGurk, tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, The Linda, thelinda.org for more information. And the playlist is posted online at wmc.org/roundtable. All right, let's get to introducing everybody and remind you that you can be a part of our program by simply writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. .org. Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you?
Here I am. I did go to Simon's Rock to walk around the track this morning. It was kind of cold out there.
Very chilly.
Yeah, and so I went and I walked around the circle upstairs over the gym. It was nice.
Yeah, very good. That's good. It's it's always a good sign of winter when I get into my car and it makes that little noise reminding you that the surfaces may be frozen, which comes on at about 37 degrees.
Right. Watching all of the stuff on CNN this morning, I decided, as I have often in the past decided, I don't really want to own a yacht.
No, nor do I want to live in Florida where the yacht may be in my living room.
I think you get the idea.
Yeah. You know, that just we'll get into that in just a moment. But thank you very much, Alan. Judith Enck is with us, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics. Judith, it seems like it's been forever. How are you?
I'm great. Nice to be back. I'm happy that later today, my husband and I are getting the new COVID booster shot. I want to say it's really easy to sign up to get it. I just went to the CVS website. It takes just a few minutes. And I am a COVID cautious person, some might say a COVID hawk. I've been skipping all sorts of events, weddings, funerals. But I'm getting this shot so I can go see Paula Poundstone at the Troy Music Hall on October 14th. I, of course, will be double masked, but there's no way I'm missing Paula Poundstone at the Troy Music Hall.
Well, that's, man, you expertly crafted that. That was good. That was like a couple pitches in there. That was good. It won't be on today, but I'm interviewing Paula Poundstone today, and then the interview will be on next week for her show. Yeah, well.
Wow, this is quite a moment in your career, Joe.
If you were here, you could help me out. But
if I had my booster, I would drive right in. Tell her I said hi.
Now, we're
Twitter friends.
Do we know Alan, Judith, or anybody what the word is on getting the flu shot and the COVID shot together?
Don't.
Okay.
Some places say do it, but my doctor, who I really trust, said to space it out by 2 weeks.
And does it matter which one you get first?
No.
Okay. All right. With that said, we go to the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. It was a little brisk out in the barn this morning, but I got to see my pet turkeys wandering around. There's about 25 of them that hang out kind of in the pastures, and it's pretty cool. But I have all kinds of events, and I haven't had my booster yet. I have to go sign up for that. Thank you, Judith.
I'll meet you at the Troy CVS.
Oh, I will be there. I have a wedding tomorrow. My husband's brother is getting married, and it's going to be lovely. And of course, was at a giant event last night. the Capital Region Chamber Dinner, which was awesome. 1,100, 1,200 people there.
Well, I'm not going there without a booster.
You know, it's a big, big room. It was, and they spaced, you know, like we weren't all sitting on top of each other, so it wasn't bad. But I wanted to mention something. I was, I'm a podcast junkie, and I was listening to a podcast a couple weeks ago, Finding Mastery, and who should be the guest but Judith Ank. It was very good, so I would encourage people to listen to it. Sorry, Judith, but I'm giving you a plug.
Thank you, Heather.
It was very good.
As if people are not already tired of hearing from me, but I appreciate it.
On the contrary.
And it's really good to know that you've been seeing other broadcasters.
Not many.
I may have just outed you.
You know, you were talking about turkeys. I took a picture last night, Heather, as I was driving home, because there were about 40 turkeys in the road.
Yeah.
And they walked across the road. And I realized I took the picture, but I can't see a damn turkey in that picture. But they're all in there somewhere.
They're hiding.
Yeah, they're hiding. But it was
You weren't drinking before you took the picture.
No, I didn't put my turkeys across the road.
That's right.
I didn't put my glasses on, though,
so that probably is what
Well, for anyone who's listening, there's zero turkeys in this picture, I'm saying.
I would just like to say they blend in. Director, actor, educator, and co-founder and artistic director of WAM Theater, Kristen Van Genhoven. Hello, Kristen. How are you?
I am good. I'm so happy to be here with another great panel. Thank you so much for having me.
It is always a delight, and we welcome you, and thank you very much for being here. We welcome you, the listener, to join in as well. If you have anything on your mind you'd like to well, we're most interested in what you have to say about what we're talking about. That helps, of course. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. With that said, on this Friday morning, let's go to what is happening and start the news of the day. I was earlier this morning, I believe... I was corresponding with Judith Ank, and Judith, what did you say about the news cycle? You said it was a
very busy.
No, you said I thought you said it was a bummer or something. I don't know. Depressing. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it wasn't you.
You sound
when
depressed.
Is the news cycle not depressing?
That's a very good point. Oh yeah, you said thanks. What a terrible news cycle. That's what you said.
Sounds like me.
Yeah, that's exactly what it said. All right. Anyway, so let's start talking about all the terrible stuff. And we begin with Hurricane Ian, which has re-intensified. It is a storm that, of course, hit the Gulf Coast on Wednesday into Thursday morning and then crossed the state of Florida, right in the center, actually. Going over and going pretty much over Orlando and then into the Atlantic Ocean. There, it started to churn up and is now expected to work its way to South Carolina. And the winds are increasing. So it was downgraded to a tropical storm from a hurricane to a tropical storm. It has now been upgraded, I believe, back to a hurricane. And 2.3 million customers without power in Florida. And the governor of the state of Florida, Ron DeSantis, says we absolutely expect to have mortality from the storm. And that certainly is the case from the individual towns that are reporting and still looking and trying to get some sense of the catastrophic damage that has been done to certain parts of the Sunshine State, especially in Fort Myers, Florida, where a lot of work.
Where my sister lives.
Oh, I'm so sorry, but I hope was okay.
Yes, I thought I'll be able to share some, like, you know, on the ground stories. So, yes, but she is, thankfully, they are okay.
700 confirmed rescues thus far, according to the governor's office. The National Hurricane Center said Ian, which is heading towards South Carolina with maximum sustained winds of about 85 miles an hour, should make its second U.S. landfall near Charleston around midday today. The governor of South Carolina said that he was not ordering any evacuations of coastal communities, but urged residents to prepare as Ian aims for the region. So there really are two aspects to the story that we'll talk this morning. We are going to get to the climate aspect, and we'll bring in Judith on that in a few moments. But before we do that, we'll talk about what happened of the devastation in Florida, and then, of course, the bracing for the second impact. Meanwhile, President Biden has approved a major disaster declaration for Florida amid what the Hurricane Center described as catastrophic flooding over its east and central regions.
Yeah, I mean, it's just devastating, I think. I've been texting this morning with my stepmother who lives in Naples, and she's fine. She doesn't have power or internet, but she said some of the stores are starting to open up again, and there's going to be a long cleanup. I'm supposed to go to a conference on Captiva in January, and I mean, by all signs, it looks like it's going to be canceled because the bridge to Sanibel, which is how you get to Captiva, is out. And that's, it's really, really unfortunate, the damage and the destruction.
Well, as Alan was saying, I mean, those pictures of just, you know, the boats being tossed around like toys, and and areas and of communities that have just been completely leveled. Judith, thanks.
Well, when I was looking at the pictures, it was eerily familiar to what I saw when I went down to the U.S. Virgin Islands after Maria. And it was just jarring because it looked so similar with the boats up on land. And you see some houses collapsed and some not. And I remember asking an environmentalist who I was staying with, because there were no hotels available when I went down to the Virgin Islands to help with the environmental response of Maria. I said, so why is this house standing and the one nearby is collapsed, like, you know, just beyond repair? And he said, well, this house met building code standards and the other house didn't. And so I think we're going to see, you know, a close look at building codes, at land use, zoning decisions and things like that. But remember, Hurricane Fiona just hit Puerto Rico 2 weeks ago, and one-fifth of the residents still do not have their electricity on, and many do not have access to drinking water. So FEMA and all of the emergency responders are going to shift to Florida because it's, you know, it's Florida, but we are now dealing with, you know, Fiona 2 weeks later, this terrible storm, and then who knows what's going to happen in Charleston, for instance, which is very, very low-lying. Tip, you've heard me say before that climate change doesn't cause hurricanes, but it makes the hurricane far more intense. It's like the warm seawater is like rocket fuel for a hurricane. So typically, if the seawater is about 79 degrees, the hurricane is going to develop and persist if it has the right conditions. For Ian, the surface water temperature was 86 degrees.
Wow.
So this is our, you know, this is our future. This is the climate crisis. We're going to run out of money doing all of the emergency response and rebuilding. And, of course, you know, loss of life and people losing their homes. And ironically, just a few days ago, Senator Joe Manchin's side deal on the Inflation Reduction Act was thankfully taken off the table. That would have resulted in fast-tracking energy projects, including fossil fuel projects, fast-tracking a fracked gas pipeline. So I just am so beside myself in terms of the disconnect between what we are seeing unfolding in real time and then the incredibly inadequate response from Congress and other elected officials. I just don't know what it's going to take for people to wake up to the climate crisis.
We need to take a break. We'll continue this line of questioning right after this short break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable on this Friday morning, the 30th of September, 35 minutes past 9 o'clock. Let us go. Judith, I cut you off, so please finish your thoughts.
Well, you know, just a couple other things to consider that's unique to Florida. One reason the storm was so damaging was also due to sea level rise, which is a major problem in coastal communities. And what we're seeing in Florida is the problem of saltwater intrusion. When you get sea level rise, it can degrade foundations of buildings. It can affect drinking water. So, you know, we just have these cascading effects. And, you know, based on my experience at EPA, once the search and rescue and recovery stage is concluded, which I think is going to be very long here, people who have buildings that they're going to try to repair and stay in are going to have a big problem we don't hear a lot about related to these storms, but it's the problem of mold, because everything has been soaked. So then you're going to have these, you know, indoor air quality problems. And I just don't think our government has enough money to deal with all of these really serious storms. And I will admit I'm a little worried that Puerto Rico is going to be left behind because, you know, Florida is a much bigger and more politically relevant. So this is just brutal. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that Governor Ron DeSantis was very vocal in voting against federal funding to help the Sandy recovery in New York and New Jersey. And DeSantis is now looking for 100% cost coverage for the Florida storms. And of course, you know, the federal government should give Florida a huge amount of money, but DeSantis was quite vocal after Sandy hit. That's all I'll say.
Alan, that was a point you were making yesterday about Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it is really unbelievable hypocrisy what some politicians will do when they think they're on the right track and get votes, and then they turn around and they look real bad. And DeSantis is a perfect example of that right now.
I don't think he's worried about looking bad. I mean, if he was, there's a lot of stuff he wouldn't have
definitely
done.
Definitely not.
I'm sorry. I missed the point of that.
Oh, I just feel like Ron DeSantis sort of doesn't care. I mean, he's not too concerned with his image. I mean, he has no problem putting people on a plane to to Martha's Vineyard, and he's just, I mean, the guy is, he lives in his own world.
Well, let me briefly, and with some trepidation, disagree with you.
Okay.
because I do think that we are in a time where politicians say one thing to one group of people and another to others. And I think when you're the governor of Florida, and you're thinking about running for president of the United States, you know, you do worry about what people in other states are thinking about your capacity.
Yeah, I think Trump really reset that bar. You know, I mean, not us here, but he got elected. He was elected after a whole lot of really offensive stuff about his views on women and, you know, and it didn't ruin his political career. I mean, you think back to, you know, Jimmy Carter got in trouble for saying he had lust in his heart.
Right.
we've come a long way since then.
Yeah.
You know?
How dare he? But there is another way of looking at this, and that is that while Carter may have messed up in there, I do think people are really at this stage of the game kind of disgusted with politicians and their hypocrisy. So you make some fine points, but
it wouldn't be right if we didn't disagree on something. So
right, quite right.
The thing about DeSantis I want to point out is, yeah, he gives all politicians a bad name, and I don't think all politicians are bad. I think many are in public service for all of the right reasons, but this corrosive MAGA effect is just turning so many people off to politics. And I do have to say the stunt of DeSantis going to Texas to get asylum seekers because he said there were not enough of them in Florida, and then flying people with deceptive and false information to Martha's Vineyard does feel like an all-time low to me. And what I'm going to be curious about is when the rebuilding process starts in Florida, is DeSantis going to be rejecting hiring low-wage immigrant workers to do a lot of the rebuilding? Because if he's to be consistent, he should discourage the hiring of low-wage immigrant workers, which he will not.
Well, are you recommending his being consistent?
No, he is not consistent, but he is so hypocritical.
Yeah. I mean, these kinds of events make or break elected officials, and I think this is a big test for him. Preliminarily, I mean, my poll of one, my stepmother, she seems pleased with the storm response so far, but I should note that she's a very, very staunch, I think, DeSantis supporter to begin with. So it's always the lens that you look through, right? If you already like the guy.
Right.
I actually, we had Chris Christie up at the Sagamore for our annual meeting last week, and he was fantastic. He was funny and really showed, you know, sort of his moderate streak. He had criticism for both sides of the aisle. And I think virtually everyone who walked out of there thought, wow, you know, he's really different than, you know, what we see now nationally. And yet, you know, what killed him, supposedly, the conversation was what killed him was that he hugged Barack Obama after he gave them hurricane relief, which just seems so stupid to me. Like, really? Yeah.
Bridge didn't help.
Yeah, I know. But I don't think I honestly don't think that's what caused him to lose a primary. I think primaries are just they bring out, you know, sort of the fringe of the party. And he's a moderate. So that puts him at a disadvantage. But he did. He got a lot of criticism for thanking the president for giving them hurricane relief. So I'm curious to see what DeSantis is going to do with Biden. They have seemed, you know, somewhat cordial.
Kristen, we have not heard from you. Let's go to your thoughts.
Yeah, I've been listening to everybody, and so many thoughts are like swirling in my head. But I have to ask if you've all seen the meme that's been going around about the breaking news. It's got the image of Governor DeSantis has rerouted Hurricane Ian to Martha's Vineyard. Did you all see that?
Oh, no.
No.
Yeah, I'm like, well, I guess they have to use humor. It's really interesting. I think I, like Heather, I've talked to a few people who think that the response of the governor in Florida is wonderful. And I, you know, we're not representative of how people are responding to this person. I think that the system is definitely broken. And the only positive I take from it is that at this point, hopefully enough of the general public is disgusted with the lack of ability of the government to get anything done, whether it's state government or federal government, and they'll actually try and vote. Although we do know that like trust in the integrity of the voting system is also at an all-time low. So it's what Judith said. It's all of it is really terrible. And it was very helpful, Judith. Thank you for obviously helpful you're on the panel this morning and can share all that information, but it's petrifying around, like, what is going to make people wake up about the climate change aspect of this? And is there any solution to preventing this from getting worse? You know, we had this, you know, dart that flew into an asteroid. I mean, is there anything that we can create that's going to help reroute hurricanes? Is there anything, like, where is there any research and, you know, R&D being done to figure out another solution to this? Or are we just going to continue to be in these cycles of the storm hits, we need emergency funding, people are dying, people are out of their homes, you know? So that's some of the things going on in my mind. I also read on the BBC yesterday, which I thought was really valid, is what the director of the Florida Division of Emergency Management said about post-hurricane, like right now in this phase of response, the homeowners need to watch out for power lines. There are people who want to get back home, and they're going to be doing things that are going to result in indirect deaths, you know, and I never even thought about the fact that that's such a reality. People getting home, tinkering with their generators, their chainsaws, getting on ladders, getting on roofs, you know, and don't have the training but are eager to clean up and get home. And he said there's significantly more deaths in a hurricane's aftermath that are 100% avoidable. So, you know, that message feels like one that should be getting out to folks. Like, you might be really eager to get back home and clean things up, but you have to be even more careful now. Plus, everybody's really tired. My sister, you know, they had to evacuate from their home after shuttering and putting up like sand barriers to prevent the flooding and staying with a friend. And just the emotional and physical labor of preparing for the hurricane does not put people in a good state to be trying to clean up. So that's, all of those things are just so concerning. And I wonder if, Judith, if you think there is any solution, because people don't seem to be waking up to climate change. And it'd be great to hear if you had any thoughts on solutions.
Well, you know, there's no scientific breakthrough on how to reroute a hurricane. However, you know, there is this whole field called climate resiliency. You know, massive amounts of discussion and money goes into hardening infrastructure, you know, lifting things out of basements. But it's a lot of common sense things, like don't build on barrier islands. And what's going to happen now is people will apply to their insurance companies and FEMA to put the very same buildings up that were just destroyed by the storm. One of the previous FEMA administrators, Craig Fugate, F-U-G-A-T-E, he tried mightily to change that policy, that if, you know, if your house is in harm's way, Allen, Fire Island.
Yes, I think about that right now.
Yeah,
and I'm glad Rosemary isn't here to yell at me. Yeah.
And, you know, and whenever an elected official or an agency official even starts the conversation, the residents, you know, mobilize and say, no, you know, we're going to rebuild here. Okay, if you want to rebuild, go ahead, but don't use federal money to rebuild. And, you know, don't rely on public resources when the house gets wiped out again. So there's those short-term policies, and then the longer-term policies. You know, we just heard Ray Graff on the news after his very intimidating statement, "Let's go Mets." It kind of it was worrisome. Like, what happens if they lose, Ray? But I want them to win. I want them to win. But during the newscast, he also announced New York Governor Kathy Hochul said that all new vehicles sold in New York State must be zero emissions by 2035. Of course, there's a lot that goes into that. You need to have enough charging stations, and you need to have the supply from the car companies, because everyone's on really long waiting lists to get electric vehicles. But, you know, that is, it's kind of too soon for Kathy Hochul to talk about that, because you have to have a period of just dealing with, you know, the horrendous impacts and the fatalities from the storm. But like in a couple days, Kathy Hochul should be talking about one of the answers to climate crisis is her policy on only electric vehicles being sold, which follows California and a couple other states are announcing this at the same time. So there is a lot we can do. We just need the political will. And to your point, Kristen, emissions that are released into the atmosphere today from power plants or tailpipes of cars last 40, 50 years. So you can't, you know, you can't turn the ship overnight. If we went to zero emissions tomorrow, we're still going to have these kind of storms for decades because the planet is warming at an unprecedented rate. The last 8 years are the hottest years on record, and the last few decades are the hottest since 1980. So resiliency plus reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which in my mind equates with no more fossil fuel burning if we are going to have a chance.
We are very late for a break, so let's take it. We will go to that and come back and continue our conversation and include listener letters as well. That means you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Want to hold my own, but I don't know how. Could live my life just for your embrace. What is love but an empty vase?
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Great group this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Henk, Heather Mulligan, and Kristen Van Genhoven. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we love hearing from you. Dan writes to us and says, we are treated as stepchildren by the U.S. government. This is from a letter writer who lives in the Virgin Islands. I traveled from West Hebron to St. Croix with supplies for my neighbors after Maria hit and saw good work by FEMA linesmen to restore power. But soon that effort slowed down, and 5 years after Maria, there are still homes under tarps. On another note, the emergency workers were given around $300 a day just to spend on their accommodations. So many of them were able to stay in absolute luxury, and residents were scrambling to make many thousands for their apartment and home rentals. They worked hard, but their daily subsidies are way out of proportion. Anything you'd like to add to that, Judith?
Well, I didn't get any daily subsidies. I'm not aware of that. $300. I mean, there were a lot of emergency response people there working almost around the clock. But it was such an intense storm, and so much more needed to be done. And, you know, there are still places in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico that, are, you know, it's not always obvious when you're there. You know, I was there just pre-COVID. But if I'm not mistaken, the hospital on the island of Vieques is still not open again. A lot of schools have not reopened. So the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are part of the United States and absolutely deserve more support and more attention. And because of climate change, you know, I was just thinking about this the other day, they're just going to get hit over and over again. And we hear the phrase climate refugees, and you think of people leaving Latin America or Africa because of the heat and the inability to farm. But we had climate refugees. Of course, these are Americans, but a lot of people left Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And where did a lot of folks go? The Orlando, Florida area. So, you know, I'm thinking of them today. You know, this double hit, and I'm afraid in the Caribbean it's just very challenging.
But you know, there are an awful lot of people listening to the radio right now who are saying, "Yeah, down there," but it won't happen here. But that's misthinking, isn't it?
Well, remember Irene?
Sure.
And then we all know people in, you know, New York and New Jersey who are impacted by Sandy. I think the 10-year anniversary of Sandy just passed. You know, these once-in-a-lifetime storms are happening every few years.
Yeah,
we all know
people
in Florida.
Sandy, I live on the Quackenkill Creek, and Sandy caused the the creek to turn into this like incredibly huge raging river, and it wiped out the road in front of my house and did damage to my bridge. I actually dealt with FEMA, the woman from FEMA was from Florida, who came up and did the assessment on my bridge and said, "Nah, you know, we're not gonna help you." And then, like 3 months later, I had a mysterious deposit from them in my checking account, which I'm like, "Okay, no one ever explained this to me." But
and which of us won't remember the water that was pouring into the New York City subways? Nobody's immune. Yeah.
And all the, remember the flash flooding and people living in basement apartments in Queens who died? I mean, it's not always a high profile, you know, official hurricane, but we are dealing with this violent weather where more rain comes down over shorter periods of time and the infrastructure, even if it was upgraded. I mean, what we hear a lot is, and I totally agree, we need to invest in better water infrastructure. But quite honestly, the volume of rain that comes out over such a short period of time, I'm not sure that improved infrastructure is going to do the trick here. But certainly not building on floodplains, not filling in wetlands, not building right up to the shoreline. You know, it's all common sense, but is often go ahead.
Well, it also sounds from how we're speaking that more effort needs to be put into having efficient emergency response systems where, you know, once the money is deployed, there's actually an efficient system that works well so that people aren't getting mysterious amounts of money in their account, or some people getting $300 a day for this. Or, you know, as somebody who's like on the receiving end of government support, there is a disconnect between hearing of like, oh, all this money is going to response. There is quite an inefficient system within those institutions of deploying that money well. So it feels like that needs to be part of the solution also, more effort into doing the emergency responses well.
Yep.
All right. With that said, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Keep them short and to the point. We'll get to as many as we possibly can. We'll do all of that. First news with Ray Graff. You can unwind. Won't you be satisfied? Don't have to work. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Heather Mulligan, and Kristen Van Genhoven. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We have been talking about Hurricane Ian that worked its way across the state of Florida and is now expected to make landfall as a hurricane in the state of South Carolina. While we've been talking about that, we've brought up climate issues. And Judith, before we leave this completely, there was an article in the Washington Post this morning about super hurricanes. And I guess I would just like to talk a little bit about the future, not so much on Ian, but what it means to be in this new reality. You touched on this, but of having that as a possibility. The numbers are really quite incredible. What Hurricane Ian did, it did what six other storms have done over the past 6 years as they approach the United States, and that's intensifying quickly. And as you mentioned, that is one of the reasons being the warming waters that are fueled by climate change, giving those hurricanes more energy. So as you look at that number, which is quite incredible, of this just over the past 5 or 6 years, of what does that mean for our future?
Well, it's not good. It's called rapid intensification of the hurricanes, and it's largely driven by the water temperature. So the warmer the water temperature, that's going to supercharge the hurricane. And then a lot of it has to do with different wind patterns, which I do not understand, but that is also a factor. And so you're going to, you know, we're a Category 2 hurricane becomes a Category 3 hurricane, which is huge.
Now, why is the water getting warmer, Judith?
Because of climate change, because of greenhouse gas emissions is causing the planet to warm, and most of the world is covered by water. So, you know, just like we're feeling hotter on a hot summer day because of warmer temperatures, a lot of that heat is absorbed in the water. And so particularly, you know, the surface water. So the warmer the water, again, the warm water doesn't cause climate change. It doesn't cause hurricanes. We've had hurricanes forever. But the warmer water supercharges the hurricanes.
Is there a fix?
Yeah, the only fix is building more resilient communities, although that doesn't really help when you have an intense storm like Ian. But the real fix is dramatically reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which means not burning so much fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
This is why climate scientists have been losing their minds for the last 30 years.
Yeah,
none of
exactly.
This is a surprise. We know that we knew this was happening, and we know it's going to get worse until we stop burning so much fossil fuel.
You know, one of the things, Judith, I don't want to go off on a total tangent here, but my
understanding. Please do.
my understanding too is that, I mean, if you extrapolate this just on warming water, it goes to even the smallest lake in the Adirondacks, where it is allowing these algae blooms to go because the water has never been at 85 degrees before. Usually you were not able to put your foot in the middle of August into an Adirondack lake without having it turned into a block of ice. Now it's so high and you're having all of these algae blooms, which are very damaging not only to humans but to pets and to the ecosystem within the lake. So it
and
isn't just
water.
Yeah, so I mean it isn't just these our oceans, it is our bodies of water, and of course we can look at the Great Salt Lake and so forth of what is happening and rivers and ..
Yeah, we are, like, the easiest way I can say it, we are totally screwing up the web of life. There are public health impacts.
It's a good title for a book.
We are, you know, the ecological impacts, and it's cascading. And there are also, you know, there are impacts we don't even know about today. Now you know why I am so intense all the time. This is, you know, you read these peer-reviewed science articles, and it's like, come on, guys, the Manchin side deal to facilitate more fossil fuel development. It's quite serious, and I'm afraid that
I often wonder how climate change activists like yourself, Judy, like, still manage to, you know, fight for this with the blindness and, you know, the conscious turning of our eyes. Like, the world has just such short-term memories, and we don't seem to be able to make changes for a better long term. We're just, it's the immediate gratification remains more important than what's best for the planet. It's so extraordinary, and I think so often about how frustrating that is for all climate activists, including yourself.
I just want to say, though, I mean, we can't solve this. Like, New York can't solve this by itself, and even the U.S. can't solve it by themselves. I mean, we need to have a global deal. I listened to a podcast yesterday where they interviewed a woman in the northern reaches of Russia, and she was complaining that, you know, it's so bad, the men being conscripted into the army there, that they can't run their coal plant, you know, and that is their primary source of heat and electricity generation in this part of the world is coal. And that's true in China. I mean, I think they're still building, you know, a new coal plant every single day. If we don't reverse that, we could do everything. We could shut the lights off here. We're still not going to stop all this climate change.
Yeah, but we don't have to shut off the lights. We just have to transition to clean, renewable energy and energy efficiency. And absolutely, this has to be an international response. But, you know, we lost valuable time when Trump pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accord. And the good news is that the cost of renewables is coming down significantly. Renewables are cheaper than gas. So why aren't we making those big investments? Speaking of podcasts, someone just told me about a podcast that, Heather, you and I should listen to. It's called Stubborn Optimism. and I think that's
that
how
sounds
climate
about right.
change activists survive, with stubborn optimism.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah,
and a little alcohol, I might add.
Or a lot.
Stubborn optimism with a little Merlot.
Love
All right. We welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let's move on to other subjects on this Friday morning. And I want to talk about this story. I'm still trying to sort of, figure it out, I guess, is the easiest, the easiest way to say it, is that the judge who originally named the special master or allowed the special master to look at the document review in the Trump Mar-a-Lago case has now said that she is overruling the special master's demands in that review. This is Judge Aileen Cannon, for those of you who remember, and a special master that she appointed, she's now struggling with over who should control the rules of the review and whom those rules would favor. And I don't say this with any, I know it's going to sound like commentary, but it's just, you know, it seems like if you set somebody up to overlook something and then you tell them, no, well, I don't want you to look at that.
He's not so special after
yeah,
all.
It's right. It's not, that's exactly
yeah,
right.
What's
it's not
the
as
point?
A special.
Right.
So the decision included a 6-page order issued by Judge Aileen Cannon was among several to ease demands by the special master, Judge Raymond Deary, under requirements he put in place in recent days. Mr. Trump's lawyers would have been forced to test excuses that have made in connection with the trove of documents taken from his estate, Mar-a-Lago. Judge Cannon also rejected a swift timetable that Judge Deary had set to resolve the review of the documents, slowing the matter down even further. Alan?
I don't trust the judge. It's that simple. We make assumptions that judges are going to be judges, that they're going to look at the evidence, that they're going to be balanced, that they're going to, you know, be fair. And then it turns out that the people who appointed them have a great deal to do with the decision. So it's almost predictable what you're going to get based on who named the judge.
Heather?
Oh, this is one of my one of my pet peeves. I don't like people making sweeping accusations that judges are beholden to the people who appoint them. I think there's been many, many executives who have appointed judges and then greatly regretted who they selected because the judges didn't rule in a way that was, you know, loyal to them or you know, somehow beholden to them.
I bet there are more on the other side.
I
but
don't
go
think
ahead.
So. Yeah. I just yeah. don't. I mean, it's hard to get to be a judge, and it's not, you know, depending on the level, but it's...
And where?
And where, but there's still a process. There's a process, and in systems where you have appointed judges. I mean, don't forget, there's some judges are elected, and one could argue, you know, that's there's a problem with that too, because there's money in politics, right, involved. But
well, and that elected politics are often appointed politics. If you think about who controls the electoral system,
I mean, you can peel apart the system. I still feel strongly that most judges are very qualified. Most judges are not partisan, and they're thinking as lawyers, and they're looking at the facts. And there's a difference between having a conservative view of the law, a conservative view of how you make a decision, and injecting conservative politics into your decision making. Well, I don't think that happens as much as people say.
Yeah, as much as I say.
As much as you say. Okay.
And let me just say, you know, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I have a bridge in Brooklyn that I'd love to sell to you.
I don't know. I feel like bridges aren't good investments right now.
No. Yeah, you can get a deal on a causeway. What about in this case, Heather?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that I didn't necessarily like the judge's approach to it earlier, and I don't like the idea of sort of, okay, I'm going to have a special master to decide all these things, except for, you know, these 12 things that I'm going to decide anyways, or I'm going to overrule you. It just looks funny to me. But I don't think that's the same as saying every judge is biased. I don't know if she's biased or not. I like to see it play out a little more.
You go as far as to say that every judge has the capacity for some personal bias.
Every human does.
That's right.
I mean, that's
my point.
But that is definitely true. But I think for the most part, judges are not beholden to the people who appoint them. I think they are independent.
Judith, think?
Well, that's what I was...
Go ahead, Kristen, and then we'll go to Judith.
Well, that's what I was curious about as Heather was talking. I was like, what are the systems in place? Because I agree that judges, it takes a lot of effort to become a judge. There is integrity that I think is very deep in judges. And there is definitely going to be unconscious bias. So I'm curious what checks and balances are in place inside the legal system to check against that.
Well, there's
a
lot.
See if that's happening.
I mean, there's a lot. There's codes of ethics. Now, one could argue whether or not they're strict enough or there's enough enforcement. But there are codes of ethics in place. There's appellate review, and appellate review is one of those I think wonderful things, because you can completely, you know, change a decision if you think there's been judicial misconduct, or prosecutorial misconduct. So, I mean, there are checks and balances in place.
Not on the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, there are exceptions, right?
That's a hell of an exception.
Well, there's an impeachment process. Mm. I don't think, you know, it's...
Oh, yeah. We see them being impeached every day, right?
Right. Well, I mean, impeachments are inherently political, and I think that's a reason why we haven't seen a lot of impeachments. In states that have recall. I mean, judges do get recalled in other states if the electorate is unhappy with them. But again, there's so much politics in that. That's a careful what you wish for. I personally am glad that New York State does not have recall, because holy cow, this place would be a mess.
Judith, thanks.
So another question I have is, did she just come to this on her own? How did she all of a sudden come out with this? You know, is this
She's a big Trump supporter.
Legal team shenanigans? And so they're like, please intervene on our behalf?
Judith has a theory. Judith?
She's a huge Trump supporter. You know, she was very politically involved supporting Trump. She was appointed by Trump. She was reversed on appeal on her last decision. I don't understand procedurally if Department of Justice or the special master, the master himself, can appeal this decision. My guess is maybe DOJ can appeal the decision. But, you know, this is pretty outrageous. Trump's MO is just to delay as long as possible. The special master, Judge Deary, put forth a more aggressive schedule that the Trump lawyers didn't like. They go back to this judge. She undercuts the special master, which I think is unusual. The special master was recommended by the Trump team. And so I think she's vulnerable on this decision. And, you know, I heard a recording the other day. I try not to listen to this dude, Roger Stone, but he was talking about how no matter the outcome, they're going to fight, you know, fight. It doesn't matter if you lost California. Yep. We're going to say we won California. And don't worry. Yep. We own all the judges that we appointed.
He's like a villain in a Batman cartoon, right? I mean, he's just...
And he's so influential.
Wardrobe and all.
Yeah.
I was reminded of, you know, him saying... You know, the Trump judges that we appointed are going to stay loyal to us. Here we go.
Yeah, well, I think he's a kook, so.
Agreed.
So where does this go now, then? I guess to Judith's point of if the DOJ is able to appeal this. If not, it gets dragged out.
Well, if they appeal it, it's going to slow things
down. Which is the playbook. You know, but that's the playbook. So it'll just
not
delay,
necessarily.
delay.
It is. They're trying to get a delay. Deary first said all of this was due the end of October, and that was even more aggressive than what DOJ asked for. And the ruling right now is that all of this will be due right before Christmas. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's a 6-week delay. But as whoever was just saying delay, it'll be followed by more attempts for more delays.
And all right, so we have about 5 minutes, and I think we have time to go to another story. Let me check in the mailbag and see what we have on this particular subject. Dear wonderful panel, I've requested interview of 7 candidates for judge positions, and none of them have responded or replied to my request. Okay. I think this is from a media person who believes that they should have access to those running for judges, and why wouldn't they respond?
No, maybe they just want to run, and they don't. I don't know. I don't think I've seen debates in judicial races, really. I don't know.
They're not allowed to talk about their positions on issues.
Right. There are a lot of rules around it. And they're not supposed to know who their donors are, and so...
But we're supposed to decide which of them we should vote for, with all of those that what they're not allowed to do.
Well, you can look at their experience. Do they have judicial experience? What's their temperament?
Oh, when's the last time we all did that?
Yeah, I was going to say, how many times have people been at a voting booth and they're looking at a name and they're like, I'll choose that name. That's a name I like. And they haven't actually done any research.
Absolutely.
Well, I have a shortcut. I just vote for Democratic women.
That's a good way to go.
That is a shortcut.
But there's starting to be more Democratic women on each ballot. So how do you decide between the options?
You can never have enough.
good comeback, Judith.
All right. Let's go. Let's see. Irene says, this is so outrageous. Trump and his team will continue to find an out, even though he is guilty. This is the way they operate, no matter what he is being accused of. That from Irene. Robert says, disbelieving that many judges are chosen for their ideological positions ignores the reality of how Republican judicial appointees happen. It's only been a few years since Republicans rejected using nonpartisan ABA evaluations of judicial competence and now exclusively uses lists provided by the Federalist Society, etc. How can anyone or anybody take those judges impartially for granted?
Well, I just disagree. I think that the process is imperfect. I think that the vast majority of people who are appointed to the bench, particularly at the federal level, are highly qualified.
Yeah, but if you're admitting, I think it's a value-laden term, I know, admitting, that it's imperfect, you're acknowledging, right, that there are some bad things that go on here in these appointments.
No, I mean, I think that you don't really know until someone is on the bench and has basically the complete unfettered freedom to write a decision, you know, how good they're going to be or if they're going to be biased or not. But I think there are checks in place, you know, to stop corruption. I do think the answer is, you know, maybe a little bit more scrutiny. I mean, we're all sitting here talking about how we really know very little about the people who are running for judge. I personally have a very good friend who's running for judge in Troy this year. And of course, you know, I know him and I know he's a great judge, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I have vetted every judge that I vote for in an elected system. And so there are pros and cons to appointments. There are pros and cons to having a judicial election. But, you know, it's all better than, having absolutely no controls. And I generally think very highly of people who sit on the bench.
Martin writes to us and says, Judge Cannon's ruling appointing a special master was unjustifiable mm-hmm. legally, and the appeals court, which included two Trump appointees, unanimously and scathingly tossed the part DOJ appealed from. Now she's undermining the special master's rulings because Trump is dissatisfied with those. She is helping him delay the proceedings, which is the whole point after all. That from Marty.
Perfect letter.
Interesting.
A lot of assumptions there, I'm just saying.
Given the perfection of that letter, or at least the perceived perfection, we will pause there. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. One more go-around with our panel. First, the news.
And I think that we could
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Last go round with the group as we have about 10-15 minutes left. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Heather Mulligan, and Kristen Van Genhoven make up the group. And again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to other subjects this morning. And I want to, we do have a lot of letters, but I'll get to those in a minute. I don't want to let marinate all weekend without discussing, I don't think. So we'll go for those. And there we go. I want to talk about Ginni Thomas.
I do too.
Ginni Thomas told the January 6th committee that she still thinks the election was stolen, that according to the chairman of the January 6th commission. Ginni Thomas reiterated her belief that the 2020 election was stolen during her interview Thursday with the committee investigating the January 6th, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, that according to panel chairman Benny Thompson. Her false assertion nearly 2 years after Joe Biden's victory came during a five-hour closed-door interview with the committee. Ginni Thomas, a conservative activist, drew the attention of the committee after investigators obtained emails between her and lawyer John Eastman, who had advocated a fringe legal theory that Vice President Mike Pence could block the congressional certification of Biden's Electoral College win. She also repeatedly pressed White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to find ways to overturn the election, according to messages she sent to him weeks after the election. The messages represent an extraordinary pipeline between Thomas and one of Trump's top aides, as the president and his allies were vowing to take their efforts, yes, all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The committee says it may use clips from her appearance if they are warranted in a future hearing, but lawmakers have not yet scheduled their next hearing as lawmakers head back home for recess on Friday, and Wednesday's hearing was postponed because of Hurricane Ian. Heather?
I just think she's that relative. So she's another character in this Batman episode, right? She and Roger Stone. It's just crazy. She's the one you don't want her to get too much into the sauce at Thanksgiving because, you know, there's going to be some kind of big family fight. I feel like it just gets nuttier and nuttier. But I will, all that being said, I still think like Clarence Thomas is allowed to have, you know, crazy relatives and not have it stick to him. And I know that there are folks here who are going to disagree with me on that. But yeah, wow. She's just out there.
Judith?
Yeah, I agree. She's out there. But, I mean, her texts and emails to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and others was, I think, a factor. And, you know, let's remember, again, the dreadful Roger Stone. You know, we, even though Clarence Thomas was not appointed by Trump, they had great confidence in their Supreme Court appointees, plus Clarence Thomas and Alito. So, you know, I think they were hoping that this would ultimately go to the Supreme Court. And look, husbands and wives have different political positions and different jobs in the modern world. Whether or not she was married to Clarence Thomas, she played a pretty bad role in terms of undermining democracy. And it's because she's married to Clarence Thomas, she could get through to the White House.
And well, she was an activist, and she had legitimately had her own career and was very politically active, separate and apart from her being married to Clarence Thomas. But so I don't want to say that like the only reason that Mark Meadows, you know, answered her text was because that's who her husband is. Because,
well, I think it played a role, though. I
mean, it may have, but I think
there are a lot of conservative activists in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But when the wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice calls, you respond if you're in the White House. And it's just totally inappropriate that she was involved at that level. She has every right to be politically involved, but knowing that this might go to the Supreme Court, that family needs to have some kind of recusal process.
Yeah, I agree with that. Totally agree with that.
Kristen?
Well, I took exception when she wrote that she described her post-election activities as minimal. I thought, you know, unless the media really took her minimal activities and blew them out of proportion. But I would definitely not say that her post-election activities were minimal. She was definitely an influencer around all of that. And, you know, the theater director in me was like, good touch, saying that he was unaware of the communications until they were leaked to the press while he was in a hospital bed fighting an infection, you know, making him look like a sympathetic character. So I thought, oh, good touch, good touch. Yeah, I agree with what everybody else is saying. You know, when I'm preparing for these mornings, I normally write different things on my little notepad. And for this, I just wrote nothing. I'm just rolling my eyes about the whole thing.
But you could write a play about it. I would go see that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I do agree that she probably, you know, husband and wives don't talk about things, and that's an ironclad rule in their home. I think that I could believe that. I think with any Supreme Court judge, with any judge, you know, with any therapist, like there are confidentiality things that can't be breached. So, but I did get a kick out of those other attempts to, you know, make him look sympathetic.
I would love to ask the entire panel whether or not husbands and wives in their cases, if there is such a case, take cues, social and political cues, from their partners.
I think
yes.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes
and
they don't.
And I'm giving you all sodium pentothal to make sure that truth is being told.
Oh, very good.
Well, spouses in general, partnerships. I mean, I have a few friends where one is a Democrat and one is a Republican, and they just don't talk politics. I think every relationship is different in terms of how, you know, how we're influenced or who influences us. So I think that's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah, I mean, I have some friends who are totally uncomfortable talking politics, or one spouse is and the other isn't.
With each other?
No, like with other people, right?
Well, how about each other?
Well, I'm not in their room with them they're just, you know, alone. That would, I could only speak to my own my own relationship.
That would be creepy,
weird, but. But I mean I think people can be very different in how outspoken they are or opinionated they are about politics, and sometimes at the great discomfort of a spouse. But you know, do you call someone out in public? I think it's all over the map. I think it'd be really boring if you just agreed with each other.
I'm sorry.
All the time.
What do you mean? Do you call somebody out in public?
Well, I mean, like if you're let's say your significant other expresses a political opinion that you really think is wrong or don't agree with, are you gonna like publicly disagree with them? You know, I mean, that's relationship politics. You want to, you know. Unfortunately, I'm like a bull in a china shop most of the time. If I don't agree with someone, I usually tell them right to their face and not think about the consequences. Unfortunately.
Oh yeah, yeah. So Alan, so what are you getting at in the sense of what do you think is happening here?
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, that's why I asked the question. In my house, I wait for Roselle to rule, and then I decide, you know, to do what she wants.
Yeah, but you may or may not, right? I mean, I think it depends on the. I really do. I mean, I think it depends. Obviously, you have two powerful people in Washington, and I assume they have come up against this a lot. I'm not defending either of them. I don't know what was going on. The whole thing is weird. I go back to your, you know, villainous idea. But it does. I mean, I do think that you can have a situation where you say, okay, you do your thing, I'll do my thing, and, you know, whatever those discussions are.
Sure.
Hopefully they won't bang into each other.
But that's not what's at play here. I mean, this is not Helen Reddy, I Am Woman, Henry Rohrer, and every woman has a right to her own political opinion. This is, if anyone remembers that song, this is a case
we
might
all
go
remember
to the
US, that song.
This case might go to the U.S. Supreme Court. She has to recuse herself because her husband is going to potentially decide.
Well, he has to recuse himself.
Yeah,
he
has to recuse himself, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what would she recuse herself from?
Right.
Well, no, she could, if she was not politically active on this topic, he would not have to recuse
himself. No, that's also true.
Well, I don't think you're right when you say has to.
Right.
Where do you see that written?
Well, the Judicial Code of Ethics for the Supreme Court
on wives?
On everything is very porous. I mean, there's...
Yeah,
there are more ethical constraints on city council members than Supreme Court members and their spouses and partners.
Not that they comply with those.
I was about to say that.
But I don't know. I just keep thinking of the movie Madagascar and the guy saying, I have an ingenious plan. I mean, that's Roger Stone, and he's got his minions, and it's a big bad.
Yeah, I just keep seeing the cartoon. You know, if there's a listener who draws cartoons, I would take Heather's Batman with Roger Stone and Ginny Thomas. I just want to see their, like, you know, outfits.
I think we're just.
I want to see that cartoon
wardrobe. I don't want to get too much in the weeds here. I just want to take this at the surface, though, that the wife of a sitting Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America believes that the election was not legal and legitimate.
Yeah.
I mean, that, just that. I mean, we could have a show on that.
Yeah.
Crazy town.
Yeah. And are having one.
Well, right. I mean, it's we're getting more into about the ethics and, you know, about Clarence Thomas and where he should fall and this going to the Supreme Court. And I get that. But, I mean, that shows us where the leaders of the conservative movement, which she is a conservative activist and has every right to say what she says and continues to, but that's the belief, which also seems to be, you know, gaining traction among those circles, right? Within those circles.
Yeah. I feel like you just put your finger on the pulse, Joe. Like if somebody said, you know, what is the core of American culture right now? I think I would say, well, we have the wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice who believes the election was fraudulent. So kind of all you need to know about this country at the moment.
Well, on that note, we'll take a...
That's a happy note.
Yeah. On that note, as Judith told us, what a terrible group of topics. And she wasn't wrong. So we will.
It's amazing we still had some laughs.
We'll pause there for this morning. My thanks to everybody for being here. Alan, thank you very much. All right, Alan is gone.
Hey, thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe.
All right, there you go.
I loved the music today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that more than you know. We also thank Heather and Kristen and Judith. We'll be back right after this.